Sesi Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada Ki Jai. ISKCON Founder Acharya Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. Dakoti Vaishnava Vrinda Ki Jai. Namacharya Srila Haridas Thakur Ki Jai. Prem Shri Gaho Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Dvaita Gadadhar Shri Vasadi Gaur Bhaktivedanta Ki Jai. Shri Shri Radha Krishna Gaur Gopina Shri Mukunda Radha Kunda Giri Govardhana Ki Jai. Vrindavan Dhamma Ki Jai, Mathura Dhamma Ki Jai, Navadvip Mayapur Dhamma Ki Jai, Jagannath Puri Dhamma Ki Jai, Gangamai Jai, Jumuna Devi Ki Jai, Bhakti Devi Ki Jai, Tulsi Maharani Ki Jai, Samaveta Bhaktivinoda Ki Jai, Gaura Purananda. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to Sri Guru and Gauranga. All glories to Sri Prabhupada. Nama Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prasthaya Bhutale Srimati Bhakti Vedanta Swami Niti Namaya. Namaste Sarasvati Deve Gauravani Pacharne Nivasesa Sanyavani Paskachari Sitarne. Vandeham Sri Guru Sri Uttapada Kamalam Sri Guru and Vaishnavamscha. Sri Rupam Sagrajatam Sahagana Raghunatham Vitam Stam Sajivam. Sadvaitam Sadvadutam Parijana Sahita Krishna Chaitanya Devam Shri Radha Krishna Padam Sahagana Lalita Shri Vishakam Vitamscha Vanchakalpa Chubhishcha Kipasindaviya Bhachapati Tanam Pavanevyo Vaishnavibhu Namo Namaha. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate
Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate
Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
It's August 14th, 2014, Skype class from Hilo, Hawaii, and we're reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 2, Chapter 7, Scheduled Incarnations with Specific Functions. Text 14. Vishnur Nuvirya Ganamam Katam. Vishnur Nuvirya Ganamam Katam. Vishnur Nuvirya Ganamam Katam Ratiha. Ya partivanya pikavir vimane rajamsi.
Ya partivanya pikavir vimane rajamsi.
Chakskambaya swaraha sak kalata tripristam.
Chakskambaya swaraha sak kalata tripristam.
Yasmatri samya saranaduru kampayanam. Please chant. Okay. Vishnu.
Vishnu.
Of Lord Vishnu.
Of Lord Vishnu.
New.
New.
But.
But.
Virya.
Virya.
Prowess.
Prowess.
Gananam.
Gananam.
In the matter of accounting.
In the matter of accounting.
Katama.
Katama.
Who else?
Who else?
Arhati.
Arhati.
Is able to do it.
Is able to do it.
Iha.
Iha.
In this world.
In this world.
Yaha.
Yaha.
One who.
One who.
Partivani.
Partivani.
The atoms.
The atoms.
Api.
Api.
Also.
Also.
Kavihi.
Kavihi.
Great scientists.
Great scientists.
Vimamei.
Vimamei.
Might have counted.
Might have counted.
Rajamsi.
Rajamsi.
Particles.
Particles.
Chakskamba.
Chakskamba.
Could catch.
Could catch.
Yaha.
Yaha.
One who.
One who.
Swarahasa.
Swarahasa.
By his own leg.
By his own leg.
Ashkalata.
Ashkalata.
Without being hampered.
Without being hampered.
Tripristam.
Tripristam.
The topmost planetary space.
The topmost planetary space.
Yasmat.
Yasmat.
By which?
By which?
Trisamya. The neutral state of the three modes.
The neutral state of the three modes.
Sadhanat.
Sadhanat.
Up to that place. Uru Kampayanam. Moving very greatly.
Muted.
Translation and purport by Srila Prabhupada. Now, there's a really funny sentence in this purport. Who can describe completely the prowess of Vishnu? Even the scientists who might have counted the particles of the atoms of the universe cannot do so, because it is he only who, in his form of Trivikrama, moved his leg effortlessly beyond the topmost planet, Satyaloka, up to the neutral state of the three modes of material nature, and all were moved. Purport. The highest scientific advancement of the material scientists is atomic energy. But the material scientist is not able to have an estimation of the particles of atoms contained in the whole universe. But even if one is able to count such atomic particles, or is able to roll up the sky like one's bedding. That's got to be one of the funniest statements anywhere in Srila Prabhupada's books. I'll read that again. But even if one is able to count such atomic particles, or is able to roll up the sky like one's bedding, even then one is unable to estimate the extent of the prowess and energy of the Supreme Lord. He is known as Trivikrama because once in his incarnation of Vamana, he extended his leg beyond the highest planetary system, Satyaloka, and reached the neutral state of the modes of nature called the covering of the material world. There are seven layers of material coverings over the material sky, and the Lord could penetrate even those coverings. With his toe, he made a hole through which the water of the causal ocean filters into the material sky, and the current is known as the sacred Ganges, which purifies the planets of the three worlds. In other words, no one is equal to the transcendentally powerful Vishnu. He is omnipotent, and no one is equal to or greater than him. Vishnur Nuvirya Gananam Katamo Ratiha Yat Partivan Yapikavir Vimane Rajamsi Jaskambaya Swarahasak Kalata Tripishtam Yasmat Trisamyam Saranan Urukampayanam. Who can describe completely the prowess of Vishnu? Even the scientists who might have counted the particles of the atoms of the universe cannot do so, because it is he only who, in his form as Trivikrama, moved his leg effortlessly beyond the topmost planet, Satyaloka, up to the neutral state of the three modes of material nature, and all were moved. So it's interesting, of course, that our goal as Gaudiya Vaishnavas, generally anyway, most of our goal, is Goloka Vrindavan. I mean, I was just talking to one of my god brothers the other day who said, I don't want to go to Vrindavan, I want to go to Dwarka. But generally speaking, we Gaudiya Vaishnavas, we want to go to Vrindavan. And in Vrindavan, there's not this sense of Krishna as God. I mean, they know, like the gopis say, you're not really the son of Mother Yasoda. You're really he who's incarnated in the Shastvita dynasty to fulfill the will of Lord Brahma. So they know, it's there. But on the other hand, they don't really know. They forget, like, you know, they'll just think, oh, maybe Krishna's a demigod. You know, and the coward boys, they'll think, maybe Krishna's a demigod, and if he's a demigod, then maybe we're demigods too, you know, and they get kind of all excited about it. So our goal is to really forget that Krishna is God, because in forgetting that Krishna is God, one can become much more intimate with him. One can come to the point of just treating him as a friend, or as a beloved, or as a son, and Krishna really likes that. I mean, I think that all the big men in the world, they have some desire just to be treated like that, just to be treated as a friend. So we can ask, why is it that in the Bhagavatam, there's so much emphasis, especially in these early cantos, but even as we go on in the Bhagavatam, why is there so much emphasis on the greatness of the Lord, on understanding his greatness? And it's something that's really emphasized. As I say, especially in the second canto, we have a list of all the incarnations, we have three lists of the universal form, and it seems that, you know, we talk about bhakti as being both the means and the end, that we don't have the view of the impersonalists where, okay, I'm going to worship the Lord and then I'm going to jettison this to merge with him. So, you know, are we doing something in that mood, or is this some part of eternal bhakti? So really meditating about why we're looking at the Lord's greatness, and I'm sure I haven't looked at all of the reasons for it. And the first is at a very low level for ordinary people in the world, which certainly includes someone like myself. But for ordinary people in the world, if we don't understand the greatness of the Lord, then we're going to engage in sinful activities. I was having a really wonderful heart-to-heart talk with my son last night. It was just wonderful. And one of the things we were talking about is the concept of shoulds, of doing things because of a feeling of duty and feeling of obligation. And we were saying that without that, then people just are irresponsible. You know, if you go to people in general and you just say, okay, you just do whatever you feel like and just, you know, just follow your heart and do whatever you like and don't care what your husband says, what your wife says, what your parents say, what society says, then you have a lot of what's going on in modern society where people are just saying there's no God, there's no law, there's no, I don't have any duty. And it's really interesting. Bhaktivinoda Thakur has in one song, he says that when I was young, I desired to earn money, so keeping in mind the codes of religion, I accepted a wife. And we were talking about how formerly people used to understand that you weren't allowed to have a job, you weren't allowed to have a business, you weren't allowed to earn money unless you were married. You weren't allowed to earn money as a renunciate. That the moment that you want to earn money, you have to take responsibility at least for a family. But this, you know, this concept of duty is pretty much gone in modern society. I'm just going to do whatever I want. So first thing to understand the greatness of God is to say, you know, there's a boss. There's a controller. Dharman tu sakshat bhagavat pranitam. Prabhupada will talk often on that level, the level of varnashram, the level of being a good person, of being a dutiful person, and following the rules because you're supposed to follow the rules. And, you know, that way you'll enjoy. And it was just a few weeks ago I was talking with somebody who was saying, oh, you know, all these religions are relative and everybody has to find their own path to God. And so I asked him, okay, well, what's your path? And he said, oh, I just want to be a good person in the world. You know, I want to be responsible. I want to be dutiful. I want to do the right thing. So that's something. That's not nothing. And that idea of wanting to be dutiful comes from understanding that God is great and he's setting the rules and he's setting the laws and I'm not. I can't make up my own laws. I can't say, you know, I'm just going to do whatever I want. And otherwise, I mean, it may even be out of fear, like Lord Kapila Dev says, out of fear of God, the wind is blowing. Out of fear of God, the planets are rotating. So maybe out of fear, well, if I don't do my duty, you know, if I don't maintain my children, if I don't serve my husband, if I don't earn an honest living, if, you know, then I'm going to get in trouble. But that's not ultimately something valuable. It's valuable as a step. I really like where Bhaktivinoda Thakur talks about in Bhakti Loka, in the Niyamagraha section, how there's different rules for people on different levels of advancement. And he says that, you know, there's a problem with jumping up to a higher level than you're capable of. And I think in ISKCON we really emphasize that a lot. You know, don't jump up to a higher level. But Bhaktivinoda Thakur also says, don't be at a lower level than you can function on. He says, if you're attached to the rules for the lower levels, then those rules act like chains around your feet. And Prabhupada talks about that a lot in terms of being attached to some sectarian religion. That, you know, it acts as chains around your feet. So, but anyway, that's one of the first reasons for understanding that God is great. That, you know, even if I can count all the atoms of the universe, I don't make the laws. And I just recently finished reading Vyasaki Prabhu's book on cosmology. And he was really emphasizing that these scientists come up with these theories just so they can say that there's no God. And it's a really fascinating book, how they come up with these theories of universal origin that have no basis in evidence and no basis in fact. And they'll go around saying, you know, well, really, we don't know what we're talking about. Oh, but we do, what we do, and you should just believe us. And these guys think, like Prabhupada says here, it's funny, this isn't in from any of the commentaries of the Acharyas. This is just Srila Prabhupada's realization here in this purport. Roll up the sky like one's bedding. You know, that's how the modern scientists think. They think they can roll up the universe and carry it around with them, that they're going to talk about some singularity that existed in the beginning that was, you know, infinitesimally small and infinitesimally dense, and they're going to be able to have some unified field theory that they can put on a T-shirt. You know, basically, you can get this kind of picture of somebody rolling up the whole universe, rolling up the sky like they're bedding and carrying it under their arm. So they think like that. And they need to know, such people need to know, no, you can't estimate the greatness of God. You can't tell, is the universe infinite? Is the universe finite? What's controlling everything? And therefore, I have to live a pious life. I can't make up my own rules. I can't just say, well, I don't feel like doing this. I don't feel like doing that. You know, I don't feel a need to do my duty. You know, it has to just come from me spontaneously, because there's an order and there's a God. But that's, again, that's not the ultimate, because on that level, you're really just on the level of karma. And you're really just in the mode of passion. Which, again, if you're below that, you're in the mode of ignorance, so you're really in trouble. But at that level, all you're going to do is stay horizontally as a human being. So then beyond that, to know that God is great, to really get to the root of our whole problem in this world, which is, I'm going to roll up the sky as my bedding and carry it around with me. You know, I'm going to be the Purusha. I mean, that's basically what Krishna does, right? That's what the Purusha does. He rolls up the universes, breathes them in. He doesn't even have to roll it up. He just breathes, you know, and gone. And we want to be the Purusha like that. And knowing that God is great helps us to give this up, you know, that I can't be the Purusha. I can enjoy as Prakriti, but I can't enjoy as a Purusha. It doesn't work. It really just doesn't work. It doesn't work because it's not real. It's not the reality. Even if I become Lord Brahma, and I can control the universe like it's explained in the 10th canto, that to Lord Brahma, the universe is just like his body. But even at that level, you know, I'm Krishna's enjoyable object. I'm Krishna's beloved, and I can't take the role of the Purusha. I cannot take the role of the controller. And one actually starts to surrender one's ego of, I'm always right. I'm always good. I'm always right. It's quite interesting. Here it's also talked about how Vamandev went through to the neutral place of the modes of material nature, the neutral state, tree samya, where the tree, the modes are samya, where they're all the same. And I've been seeing lately how as long as one is controlled by the modes, the main way in which the modes control us is to constantly have us assert that we're right, that we don't have any faults, to rebel very deeply against any indication that we have fault of any kind. You know, except maybe for social lubrication, that, oh yeah, yeah, I'm sorry, I have some fault, but just so people will like us and get along with us. But this seeing the greatness of God and to see how absurd it is that I'm trying to take the position of God, who can put his toe through the coverings of the universe. And then one gives up this false desire to be right and becomes happy at being insignificant. One starts to take pleasure and joy at being insignificant. And just like in Brihad Bhagavatamrita, Narada and Uddhava are explaining to Gopakumar when he's in Dwarka in the spiritual world, that without deep humility, it's not possible to have love. So a lot of this understanding of the greatness of the Lord leads to humility. And then beyond humility, unless one has real humility, then it's very hard to go further. I think it's impossible to go further. That to come to this state where the modes are neutral in one's life, it seems to be predicated on this really deep humility, which is the thing that most people who take up a spiritual life run away from, and the reason why spiritual life is so long and hard for most people, why it's a bahunam janmanam ante yanamamam prapadinte vasudevam sarvamiti samahatvasadurlubha. I think we're so terrified of seeing that I'm small and God is great. And then we can gain real appreciation. So that's the next step. You know, once one just starts with genuine humility, which is such a relief because you don't have to pretend that you're something you're not anymore, then you can really start to appreciate Krishna. It's very hard to appreciate anybody when one is proud. I mean, if you just, you know, if you hang out at all with really grossly materialistic people ever, you know, at work or at school or with family, and you just see that people who are under the modes of material nature can't appreciate each other. They're so wrapped up in wanting the other person to appreciate them and the other person to see how great they are and surrender to them that their ability to appreciate the other person is very compromised. Well, to speak of wanting to appreciate Krishna. So when you really appreciate Krishna, you have to appreciate Krishna from the point of view of our own position. So after deep humility starts, then appreciation starts. One doesn't see Krishna as threatening anymore. You know, I was speaking to one devotee the other day about what was going on in his life, and we were looking at his astrological chart and saying, you know, well, this is obviously a time in your life to do austerity. And the devotee said to me, you know, why does Krishna set up subtle forces to try to push us to do things? So that's the problem, that it's hard to appreciate that Krishna is working to help us, that Krishna is wonderful, and how incredible Krishna's greatness is when we don't have this essential humility. And when one appreciates Krishna, then one's full of wonder and excitement and getting into this unfolding mystery of Krishna. Because it's often said that not only can the devotees not fully understand Krishna. I mean, here it's talking about the scientists. But even the devotees can't fully appreciate Krishna. Even Krishna can't fully appreciate Krishna. That Krishna is always expanding, and then his knowledge of himself expands. But he expands faster than his knowledge of himself, so he always has more things to discover about himself. And, you know, the modern psychologists say that in happy relationships in this world, we're always discovering more things about the people that we love. You know, if we say, okay, now I know everything about you, then it becomes boring. Okay, now I've achieved mastery. There's nothing more to achieve. So when one gets appreciation, then one starts to appreciate not just Krishna's greatness, but Krishna's constantly unfolding greatness, his unfolding mysteries. And then one gains love. So ultimately, this appreciation of Krishna's greatness, leads to love. Now, what is love? So there's some modern therapists who've analyzed love in a way that I thought was really helpful, and that is that I really like you. I'm able to look at you and say, this appreciation, I really have appreciation for who you are. And that's interesting with Krishna, because Krishna is a person, and as a person, it's very easy to look at Krishna and see fault. I mean, in fact, we have so many scholars who look at Krishna and see fault. Oh, why is he dancing with the gopis? I mean, a lot of the gopis Krishna is dancing with are at least superficially married to other men. I mean, that seems like a pretty big fault from a moralistic point of view. You know, in so many of our temples, we have deities of Radha and Krishna, and we don't say to the general public, you know, here's God with his chief consort who's married to somebody else. So one could look at Krishna and see fault like that. And in fact, people do. People even see fault in Krishna's management of the material world. Well, Krishna, if you really love me and you really want me to be Krishna conscious, why'd you give me cancer? Why'd you give me this wife? Or, you know, why aren't you giving me any money? Or whatever. You know, so one can look at Krishna in terms of material management and find fault. And one can look at Krishna's eternal pastimes and find fault. You know, why is Krishna picking up the wheel on the battlefield of Kurukshetra? And why does Krishna let the Pandavas suffer so much? Why does Krishna promise that he's going to come back to Vrindavan? And, you know, it's just, again, reading the Brihad Bhagavatamrita and how Krishna goes to Mathura and everyone in Vrindavan is so devastated. Mother Yasoda's begging, you know, Nanda Maharaj, promise me. You're not going to come back without Krishna. Yes, I promise. And Krishna doesn't come back. And Prabhupada even says in Krishna book, he says Krishna is not a liar or a cheater or a breaker of promises. But you think, well, it certainly sounds like that. It certainly sounds like he broke his promise and he cheated the residents of Vrindavan. So to gain love, the first thing of love is that you see the good qualities in someone and you see their faults as good qualities. You interpret their faults as good qualities. You don't really see faults. That really comes up in chapter 32 of the 10th canto, which is a seminar that I've given, where the gopis are questioning Krishna, why did you call us to Rasalila and leave us in the middle of the night? And Krishna ultimately explains, I did this to glorify you, to glorify your love. And the acharyas, particularly Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur, explains that the gopis then saw Krishna's leaving them, which from many angles of vision was a grievous fault. They saw that as Krishna's demonstrating their love for him. They interpreted his behavior in that way, and then they interpreted their behavior as criticizing Krishna as a fault. So they reversed it. They started out by saying, oh, Krishna is just ungrateful and he leaves us in the middle of the night and we're so devoted to him. And by the end of the conversation, they understood, oh, we were trying to criticize Krishna and actually Krishna was trying to glorify us. So this is the first thing in love, is that one sees the good in the others and one sees their so-called faults in a kind manner, that one doesn't focus on the faults in others. And this is when we feel loved, it's like that. You know, I'll say to people that I like to be around somebody who doesn't think I'm a saint because I have good qualities and doesn't think I'm a demon just because I have demoniac qualities, who sees me holistically as a person and likes me for who I am. So by understanding Krishna's greatness, we come to that kind of love, that we understand the things about him that are difficult and that may appear to us to be criticizable. We see those things as glorious and we focus on how wonderful Krishna is. And the next thing in love is that you value someone. That you say, this person is important. And to the extent, as I said, Krishna goes to Mathura. It goes to Mathura, I mean, he goes to the forest. Krishna just goes to the forest for a few hours, and without Krishna right next to me, you know, I'm finished, I'm devastated, my life is over. So, you know, that's love. When you don't love someone, you don't really care if they're there or not. It doesn't matter whether you see them or not, whether you talk to them or not, whether they're in your life or not. But love means this person is important to me. You know, I can't imagine my life without them. I wouldn't be able to go on. Again, you know, you see this in the world where someone dies and the other person, I have one devotee friend who told me her father died young in a car accident. And right after the cremation, her mother got into bed and never got out again. Stayed there for a year in bed and then died. So this is the view of love. You know, I need you. I depend on you. You're important to me. And the last thing is, I'm there for you. You're there for me. I'm there for you. I have your back. You know, this is the concept of shelter. That I'm there for you. Not only that Krishna is there for me, but that I'm there for you, Krishna. You can depend on me. So these things come, these parts of love, this appreciation of someone else, this seeing them as good, this seeing them as important, to value them, and this being there for them. This comes very much from seeing the greatness of God. And it's not exactly that gets jettisoned at the higher levels in Vrindavan, because even though the residents of Vrindavan are focusing more on Krishna's sweetness, they do see Krishna's sweetness in the context of greatness. They just don't, that greatness just simply doesn't interfere with the sweetness quotient. Rather, it nourishes it. So we have, say, Arjuna, when he sees the universal form, his seeing Krishna's opulence interferes with his sakya rasa. It interferes with his ability to feel intimate with Krishna. you know, as you were saying, we were sitting on the same bed and we were eating at the same time and joking together, and I was saying, you know, oh, Yadava, you know, like, oh, you're just a prince, the Yadus are never going to rule, and yeah. But when the Mother Yasoda sees the universal form in Krishna's mouth, it enhances her feelings of intimacy. It doesn't interfere with them. When the residents of Vrindavan see Krishna lifting Govardhan Hill, I mean, that's, you know, here we're talking about Trivikram putting his toe through the coverings of the universe, which I'm going to read something about that in a minute. But you think about, you know, lifting a mountain. I mean, my goodness. You know, just like recently here on the Big Island, there was a hurricane, Izelle, that was broken up by the mountains, Mauna Kea and Mauna Loa. And it's described, I can't remember if it's Gopal Champu or Nanda Vrindavan Champu, that along with the rain sent by Indra, there were hurricanes. And Krishna defeated them with a mountain. You know, he put the mountain in the way of the storm, of the hurricane. So that's pretty cool. I mean, that's greatness. You know, if here on the Hawaiian Islands, if some little 7-year-old boy went to Mauna Kea and picked it up and carried it over to the shore and stuck it right in the way of the hurricane and stopped the hurricane, I mean, that's immeasurable, unfathomable greatness. And indeed, after Krishna did that, the cowherd men were talking with Nanda and saying, you know, who is this boy? Is he God? Are we going to go to Vaikuntha after we leave this planet? You know, is Vaikuntha our destination? And then Krishna showed them, of course, the Vaikuntha worlds and Goloka Vrindavan in the Jamuna. So my point is that the residents of Vrindavan do see Krishna's greatness. They do understand Krishna's greatness. So it's not that that stops. It's not that we get to a point where we say, okay, now I'm entering into the Vrindavan mood, and therefore I have no interest in Krishna's greatness anymore. You know, I'm only going to talk about Vastaharan Lila, I'm only going to talk about Ras Lila, and I'm not going to talk about these things. Because we find that Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, who was certainly in a Vrindavan mood, he was having the mood of Srimati Radharani, that he was reading the whole Bhagavatam. And Giradhar Pandit, who's the incarnation of Radharani, you know, she's reading the Bhagavatam so much and crying over it, all of the Bhagavatam, not just the 10th canto and not just Krishna stealing butter, but this part of the Bhagavatam also, and the structure of the universe and the descent of the Ganges. And it's not that by them studying such things that they were inspired to those levels of dharma. I have to be a good person. I have to maintain my family. I have to please my husband. It's not that they were inspired like that, nor were they even inspired to giving up the false ego. They'd already given up their false ego. I mean, and of course, Mahaprabhu and Giradhar Pandit aren't in that category at all. But this was nourishing that love. And we find, again, the Bhagavatam itself, Maharaj Parikit, this always astonishes me. Maharaj Parikit has 7 days to live. And what's he doing with his 7 days? He's hearing the Bhagavatam. He's hearing the Bhagavatam. He's hearing this section of the incarnations. He's going to hear about the structure of the universe and as referred to here, the Ganga, the descent of the Ganga. So he's going to be hearing that. I mean, it's interesting because we often, as members of the Krishna consciousness movement, as followers of Srila Prabhupada, we often wouldn't think like that. If somebody tells us, if some doctor tells us that you have, you know, 4-stage cancer and you have 7 days to live, we probably wouldn't sit down and start reading the 2nd canto or reading the 5th canto. We'd probably say, oh, you know, tell me Krishna's Vrindavan Lila. But we see here that these devotees are finding their nourishment by Krishna's greatness. So wherever we are, if we're struggling with sinful activities, if we're struggling just to be a dutiful, good person in the world, or if we're at the point of wanting to surrender our ego and our will to the Lord and enter into a loving relationship, or if we're beyond that where we're really gaining appreciation, or if we're beyond that where we're really entering into intimate love, that can all be nourished and helped by focusing on Krishna's greatness. So I thought we'd look at here, because it's talking about going through the levels of the universe. And what I find the nicest description of the levels of the universe is in the Brihad Bhagavatamrita. So, there's a description which I once briefed, so I wanted to read here. So this is Gopakumar speaking. He says, I saw that my body was no longer made of the five gross elements. Going through the circle of the sun and then going higher, I saw that the different planets were filled with defects, decorated with false shadows of happiness, and filled with illusions as desires seen in a dream. I reached the universe's coverings, which had happinesses and opulences millions of times greater than that of the planet of Brahma. I came to the coverings of gross material elements and the subtle material elements, and which contain many great pleasures enjoyed by living entities free from the gross elements. First, I entered the covering of Earth, where I saw the supremely opulent Earth goddess, who, with offerings of things difficult to get in the material universes, was worshipping the Lord, who had the form of a great boar, the pores of his body, the place from which the universes come. I saw the entire material universe, including its ingredients, were present in her, its subtle cause. Putting aside the worship of the Lord, the Earth goddess welcomed me as a guest and asked me to stay for some days and enjoy the happiness there. Taking her permission, I quickly went through that covering as if being somehow dragged through it, and I came to the other coverings. In those other coverings, I saw, one after another, Lord Matsya, that's going to be in water, Lord Surya, in fire, Lord Prajumna, in air, Lord Aniruddha, in ether, Sankarshan, in ego, and Vasudev, in the Mahatattva. So the deity of water was worshipping Matsya, the deity of fire was worshipping Surya. Each gross element and then each subtle element manifested greater and greater objects of worship, worshippers, enjoyment, beauty, and glory. Passing through these coverings as before, I came to the very dark covering of material energy, its dark color very pleasing to the eyes. Of course, there's also a description of this in 10th Canto, chapter 89, where Krishna and Arjuna go through these coverings to see Mahavishnu. Seeing this dark color, so like the color of my worshipful Lord, I became very pleased and did not wish to go any further. The very beautiful material nature, concluding the worship of her deity, the splendid form of Mohini Devi, at once approached me. Placing Anima and the other mystic powers as an offering before me, she begged me to stay, as had the earth goddess and the other deities. She affectionately said, "If you wish liberation, then you must please me, for I guard the door to it. If you wish devotional service to Lord Vishnu, then you should worship me, for by his mercy I am his maidservant, sister, and potency." Thinking of her as Lord Vishnu's potency, I bowed before her, and ignoring everything, wandered about to gaze at the covering, which had a very beautiful color. In other words, he ignored all of her offerings of mystic powers, which was supremely glorious, which was enjoyed by many individual spirit souls, manifesting forms of subtle material elements, which had many forms, which was difficult to understand, which had opulences that charmed the heart, which was worshipped by the gross and subtle material elements, and which consisted of the material universes. Then I traveled a great distance through that darkness, and finally I saw a light so splendid it made me close my eyes. So that's a description of the material coverings of the universes. And each one is 10 times thicker. So you have the universe, you have the covering as Earth is 10 times thicker than the whole diameter of the universe, and then water 10 times thicker than Earth, and so forth. Finally, ultimately, with Prakriti, which is what's being talked about here, this Trisamya, the neutral state of the three modes. And then beyond that, the Ganga. So it's described, that, as Prabhupada says here, with his toe he made a hole through which the water of the causal ocean filters into the material sky. So there's a hole through all that coverings. If you think about how thick that is, and Vamadeva, just this little boy, you know, with this little tiny, teeny tiny toe. and with his toe, he penetrates through these coverings, and the Ganges flows. And of course, there's a nice description in the 17th chapter of the 5th canto about the Ganges. So there it says, Lord Vishnu appeared as Vamadeva in the sacrificial arena of Bali Maharaj. Then he extended his left foot. So we have this idea of the left, you know, Krishna holding up the mountain with his left hand, Vamadeva with his left foot, and pierced a hole in the covering with the nail of his big toe. So not even his toe, So all these thick coverings full of these subtle elements, and just the nail of his left toe. Through the hole, the pure water of the causal ocean entered the universe as the Ganges River. So, of course, there's that description of Mahavishnu lying on the causal ocean that we find, you know, when Arjuna and Krishna go there, and they're seeing this great ocean of that's alive. The ocean is living. It's not part of the material world. It's like even Jesus said to the woman at the well, he said, I can give you living water. So having washed the lotus feet of the Lord, which are covered with reddish powder, the water of the Ganges acquired a very beautiful pink color. Every living being can immediately purify his mind of material contamination by touching the transcendental water of the Ganges, yet it remains ever pure. After 1,000 millennium, the water of the Ganges descended on Dhruvaloka. Therefore, the sages call Dhruvaloka Vishnupad. Knowing that the Ganges washed the lotus feet of the Lord, Dhruva Maharaj to this day accepts that water on his head with great devotion. Because he constantly thinks of Krishna very devotedly within the core of his heart, he's overcome with ecstatic anxiety. Tears flow from his half-open eyes and eruptions appear in his entire body. The seven sages on planets below Dhruvaloka, they keep Ganges water on the tufts of hair of their head, concluding that this is the ultimate wealth. After purifying those seven planets near Dhruvaloka, the Ganges water is carried through the spaceways of the demigods in billions of celestial airplanes. There it inundates the moon and finally reaches Lord Brahma's abode on top of Mount Meru. Then it divides into four branches, each of which gushes in a different direction, known as Sita, Alakananda, Chakshu, Bhadra. So there's this whole branch, this whole description of the manifestation of the Ganges. And then we can look here again into, I don't have this immediately open, so this is going to give me a minute here to find this. I'm sorry. I'm just looking here for this description of the outside of the universe. So that's described, of course, and oh my goodness, this seems to be very hard to find. Maybe I can't find it. Anyway, that's described in Krishna book and is described in the Bhagavatam. And I am looking to find that because it's such a beautiful description. It's described in chapter 89, where the Brahmin's son is being kidnapped by Mahavishnu. And it says here that they came again to this darkness, the same darkness described in the Brihad Bhagavatamrita. It says they entered the vast region of total darkness. In that darkness, the chariots, horses, Shaibya, Sugriva, Megapushpa, and Balahaka lost their way. Seeing them in this condition, Lord Krishna sent a Sudarshan disc before the chariot, shining like thousands of suns, it penetrating the darkness with its blazing effulgence. Following the Sudarshan disc, the chariot went beyond the darkness and reached the endless spiritual light of the all-pervasive Brahmajyoti. From that region, they entered a body of water, resplendent with huge waves being churned by a mighty wind. Within that ocean, Arjuna saw an amazing palace, more radiant than anything he had ever seen before. Its beauty was enhanced by thousands of ornamental pillars bedecked with brilliant gems. In that palace was the huge, awe-inspiring serpent, Anantasesha. He shone brilliantly with the radiance emanating from the jewel on the thousands of hood, and reflected from twice as many fearsome eyes. He resembled white Mount Kailash, and his neck and tongue were bright blue. So that's also the description there of the going beyond the darkness. Another interesting point here is this tree Samya, this place where the modes of nature are neutral. So that is this area of darkness, the area of Prakriti. But interestingly enough, even in our own daily lives, there's a time every day when the modes of nature are neutral, and that is the Brahma Muhurta. So when I was studying Ayurveda many years ago to teach it in Gurukul to some of my high school students, one of the things that we learned was that different times of the day were governed by the different modes, but that right before sunrise, the modes were in equilibrium. It was this tree samya. And just like Gopakumar found in that area of tree samya, the goddess of Prakriti worshipping Mohini Murti. And she says to him, I am the Lord's sister in potency. And if you respect me, I can give you bhakti or I can give you liberation. So in a similar way, we use that time of the tree samya to engage in bhakti. Of course, we should engage in bhakti all the time, but particularly we use that time. I was just reading where Prabhupada says that there's more efficacy, there's more effect from doing our service in that time. And of course, after that time, it comes to a predominance of goodness. And then as the sun really rises, then the mode of passion kicks in. So we should be asking ourselves as we engage in our activities of devotion and as we meditate on Krishna, you know, am I being inspired in these ways? Am I being inspired? Is my meditation on Krishna inspiring me at least to be a dutiful and responsible person following the laws of God? Is it at least having that effect? Is it inspiring me to surrender my ego, or am I holding on to my ego? Am I holding on to my sense that I'm a great person in the world? And ultimately, is it inspiring me to really love Krishna, to really appreciate Krishna's great qualities, to see everything about him as worshipable? Is it inspiring me to see that Krishna is valuable to me, that he's meaningful to me? Is it inspiring me to see Krishna as my shelter and to be there for him, that he can depend on me? And in that mood, we want to hear everything about Krishna's greatness. We're equally happy to hear about the universal form as described here in the second canto three times. We're happy to hear about the coverings of the universe and the Ganges water and Trivikrama. And no matter how great we are in material estimation, even if we're carrying the sky rolled up as our bedding under our arm, then we're entering into this sweet relationship with Krishna. So, questions, comments, additions, subtractions, chastisements.
Karanodakshya Vishnu. Mool Shankarshan, going up, Mool Shankarshan. It takes all of that Vishnu sky and the material sky to arrange for one flower to be in service in Goloka. What is that noise?
Oh, I have to put you on speaker, so the recording will pick up what you're saying. But when I put you on speaker, then it goes back into my mic.
And it goes into my ears.
Sorry, I've turned it down a bit.
Okay. That is the value of one speck of dust in Goloka. And all of this, that's why it's been coming up again and again in these classes. The first two cantos are the first of the lotus feet of Krishna. So it takes all of this tattva to support. And so if someone jumps ahead and just wants to hear Hindu love stories in the 10th canto, you are out of it. You're not getting it correctly.
Thank you.
Also, what you said about the... Also, what Dhritakarma mentions also, that the scientists, not only they support, say what supports their atheism, but if they see things that contradict Darwin and other atheist things, they cover it up. They have expelled the scientists for... So they found advanced human skeletons in rock formations that are supposed to be 10 million years old. That lady archaeologist was expelled from Harvard. If they could get a microscope and see Paramatma looking back at them, they wouldn't tell anybody.
Thank you.
By the way, are you in that picture on the USA cover, USA Today, with me and Indra Kirtan?
No, I'm in the I'm in the old BTG photograph with you on the rooftop.
Okay.
And you can see in that photograph, you can see my son and daughter who are here with me in Hawaii.
What verse in the Bhagavatam, when you Brihat Bhagavatam, Rita, were you reading for the layers?
Oh, I just closed that window. I'm so sorry.
You remember the chapter? I have a book version, but it says part one or part. Do we have the complete Brihat Bhagavatamrita now?
Yes. Yeah, three volumes.
Wow.
In this verse, at the very end, when it says all are moved, does that mean like emotionally moved? What does that mean?
That's a very interesting point. I really don't know. And I didn't touch on that because...
And then I thought, Vamanadeva, he took back the entire universe from Bali and the demons and gave it back to the demigods. And so, you know, everybody had to move to new residences. All were moved.
Then this drop of water, the causal ocean is divine. It is divine water. Brahmajyoti, divine light. So one drop, which is of spirit, is unlimited, infinite. And that one drop comes hurtling down to earth. And you can imagine when you ever see these capsules that re-enter the earth's atmosphere like that, it's coming down at the earth like an asteroid. And it would have destroyed the earth. So Shiva, in his expansion in the Himalayas, catches that water in his jata, in his matted locks, and has been releasing it. And out the Ganges, out Gomukhi, ever since. And it follows the path, and there's the story of Bhagirathi's sons disturbed Kapila, who was sitting at the ocean near Bengal. It's the Sagar. Mela is there every year. And his sons disturbed Kapila. He opened his eyes, and they were burnt to ashes. And he said, my sons, and Kapila says, when the Ganges washes over their ashes, they will return to their lives again. So Bhagirathi goes to Shiva, and Shiva's releasing the Ganges, and he rides his chariot, cutting the bank, the bed of the Ganges from the Himalayas all the way through India to the ocean. And then the Ganges flows over their ashes and they all rise up, restored. That's why the Ganges takes that course. Goes through Navadvipa.
Nice.
Goes through Prayag, Tribeni. It's joined with Jamuna and Saraswati River at Prayag. And again at Navadvipa. This all is in a microcosm. I explained it, the Ida, Pingala, and Sushruma, these rivers that interflow in our bodies. And where they meet, there's a chakra. In the world, where they meet is a place of pilgrimage, a tirtha. Tribeni, Prayag, Navadvipa. And then the ocean itself, Sagar. You can't make this stuff up, folks. And this is what gives me sraddha, faith, that this is such a comprehensive, codified science. It's you can't... and it is covered over thousands of years. And avatars of every different form, like... that was a new thing that I just heard, that Matsya in water, etc. Matsya representing a water. What was the other one?
Oh.
Water, Matsya, avatar.
Okay, let me go back to this list. So we have, yes, we have Bhumi is worshipping Varaha. Then we have the deity of water, who's not described. The deity of water is immersed, well, it's not, the name isn't given who that is specifically, worshipping Matsya. Then the deity of fire, which again is not named, is worshipping Surya Narayan. Then we have the deity of air is worshipping Prajumna. The deity of ether is worshipping Aniruddha. The deity of ego is worshipping Shankarsana, who's also, of course, worshipped by Lord Shiva, who's personified ego. And then finally, there's the Mahatattva, which is worshipping Vasudev. And then beyond the worship of Vasudev, there's the Prakriti itself, the actual Prakriti nature, who's worshipping Mohini Murti. And that's the area of this darkness that's the same color as the Lord. And that is the place where the three modes of material nature are in equilibrium.
Do you have a number for that verse?
Singular number?
No, I still don't have a number for it. Look that up. I still don't have a number. Let me look it up.
Okay.
Anybody else have any questions or comments?
I have a question. As far as these living entities that are within the coverings of the universe, they are more elevated than Lord Brahma, but they're still in the material world?
Yeah, isn't that interesting? They're not more elevated than Brahma in terms of management, because they're not in gross forms in the material world. You know, they're in subtle forms. Like when Gopakumara went there, then he saw the, one second, because I'm looking this up. Okay, so this is in Brihad Bhagavatamrita. The one about Mohini Murti is 2.3.25. So, yeah, and there it's explaining that there's many, many living entities there who are enjoying the subtle forms of material nature. Like here in Gopi Pranadana Prabhu's translation, he says this covering was inconceivable, utterly enchanting in opulence, and many in its forms all at once. The whole of material creation dwelt within it, with all the elements of creation, subtle and gross. But yeah, there's living entities there enjoying subtle pleasures. Let me go back to this. Yeah, it's beyond. And let me go back to one of these other verses. He says, each covering was the subtle cause. This is text 22. Each covering was the subtle cause of the one before it, and had a greater object of worship, a greater worshiper, and greater sense gratification, opulence, and importance. And in each one, yeah, there was a... that's the causal ocean, which is called sometimes an ocean and sometimes a river. Yeah, but each of these coverings have entities there that are enjoying these subtle forms of material pleasures. So they're not like, you know, lords of the world in terms of demigods. Yeah. All right. I think I need to go. Yeah. No, I can't do that. Thank you so much, Srila Prabhupada.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, Srila Prabhupada ki jai.
Ki jai.
Jai.
Hare Krishna.
I will be out.